One of this century's greatest writers in the English language was the Russian-born Vladimir Nabokov. His letters to family, friends, editors, publishers, and fellow writers are collected in a new book. The book is edited by his son Dmitri and his former student Matthew Brookley. The letters date to the time Nabokov and his family arrived in the United States in 1940, to his death in Switzerland in 1977. Many of the letters concern the difficulty he had publishing his best-known novel, Lolita. The book was controversial in its time because it's about a middle-aged man's obsession with a 12-year-old nymphette. I asked Dmitri Nabokov if his father would have wanted his letters published.
I know that father wrote most of his letters with the same precision, the precision of the artist and the passion of the scientist, because he was aware, as he was of many things, that what he wrote would go down in the record. When he was first writing Lolita, he referred to it in writing to one of his correspondents as a time bomb, so he had an inkling of what might happen, even though later he almost destroyed the book. So I think that he would have probably not disapproved the project. He might have edited it differently, but I hope not.
There are many letters in this collection about Lolita. Let me ask you to read a letter about Lolita that was written in 1956 about why he really didn't think anyone could possibly seriously see the book as being pornographic.
This letter was written to Professor Morris Bishop of Cornell, who was single-handedly instrumental in having father come to Cornell as a professor and was his only intimate friend on campus. The letter written on 6 March 1956 reads partially as follows. I calmly lean on my conviction that it is a serious work of art and that no court could prove it to be, quote, lewd and libertine, unquote. All categories grade, of course, into one another. A comedy of manners written by a fine poet may have its lewd side, but Lolita is a tragedy. Pornography, quote unquote, is not an image plucked out of context. Pornography is an attitude and an intention. The tragic and the obscene exclude each other.
There's a letter about Lolita that was written to you by your father, who was pretty angry about something that you were participating in. This concerned the casting of the movie Lolita. And do you want to explain what you were doing and then read the letter about it?
Somewhat shamefacedly, yes. In my early years in Milan, I went to complete my singing studies and then to make my debut. In Milano, I became friendly with a somewhat suspect publicity agent who talked me into the following scheme. Lolita was just having a big play in the press in Italy. The Italian translation had come out, and there was talk of the film, which Stanley Kubrick was preparing in America. The idea was this, that we would have a Lolita contest held at my apartment in Milan with a jury of my fellow opera singers, many of them from La Scala, including people like Anna Moffo, who gamely participated in this. With, of course, a predetermined winner, who was a lovely little ballerina at La Scala, and a good time to be had by all and to be covered by the Italian newsreels of the time. Being in my 20s, adventurous and fond of pretty girls, I said, okay, let's do it. Bad mistake. At dawn, provincial mothers with decidedly post-pubescent nymphets in tow started arriving at my house. I had no idea what to do with them. Finally, I found myself with this procession of candidates and everybody having a great time. And a few days later, my father saw in a Paris magazine his son surrounded by other buxom girls in a huge satin-covered bed, all clothed, all decent, but still. He had kept far away from casting matters. In fact, he didn't know how the thing would be cast. He didn't envisage having a 12-year-old girl play Lolita then. Maybe now he would have. He thought at one point, as he wrote in one of his letters, that perhaps she should be played by a dwarfess. When he saw this, he wrote me a rather indignant telegram followed by the letter which I will now read you. My dear, this comes, by the way, from Mandeville Canyon Road in Los Angeles, where he had been completing work on the script. Today I sent you a telegram asking you to stop the, quote, Lolita publicity, unquote, and would like to say the following to you. This publicity is in very bad taste. It can only harm you in the eyes of those who take music seriously. It has already harmed me. Because of it, I cannot come to Italy, since the reporters would immediately pounce on me there, and I would have to deny categorically everything that you or your agent have been saying. Here, I have resolutely kept my distance from the search for an actress and from all casting matters. This was in the interest of my reputation and also in that of the producer. I cannot tell you how unpleasant, repugnant even, I find the reports in the Italian press linking you with a presumed search for an actress who has, incidentally, long since been found by Kubrick and Harris. No less important is that this unhealthy ruckus can only dilute your young fame.
Were there other ways that you felt you were used by
Oh, I'm pretty good at not being used. This was kind of fun, and I was the guilty party here.
Right.
I pretty well take care of myself, and he was absolutely right. Although he was such a nice, indulgent father, that he quickly forgave me, and we had many good laughs over the thing afterwards.
In one of the letters, your father writes to you what he calls an instructive little jingle. Would you recite that jingle for us and explain why he wrote it?
In Italy, for his own good, a wolf should wear a riding hood. I think it's even more cogent in these days of dread diseases, but even then, my parents were rather concerned that being a vigorous bachelor, I might pick up the wrong thing from the wrong girl.
Hence the riding hood. Okay.
It shows you, you know, how humorous and warm he was even in little things like that. He was a great father. We had laughs about everything.
Were you very self-conscious when you were growing up about speaking or about writing? You know, because your father was so precise with his language and also so funny with his use of it and so creative with it. I mean, his books are filled with puns and anagrams and complex wordplay. Did it make you self-conscious about just being able to speak extemporaneously?
I'll begin by commenting on speaking extemporaneously. When I was in prep school, I loved speaking and debating. Besides, that was one way of getting out of school for a weekend, that and sports. I was on the debating team, on the public speaking team, on the extemporaneous and impromptu speaking squad, and I won a New Hampshire and a New England championship in those things because I enjoyed doing it very much. That was long before I became delicately and intimately conscious of the intricacies of my father's style. However, what I can say is that he never made me self-conscious. He allowed me to collaborate both in the translations and sometimes in revising and checking and proofreading. He checked some of my early, very naive attempts at fiction and poetry. He never became an ogre, a monster, an overwhelming, frightening figure. He was always indulgent and nice and not overly critical and helped me along. I can also say this, that I think that the apprenticeship that I almost subliminally had with Father over the years, plus the supreme legacy that he gave me at his death, oddly, that of inspiration, was instrumental in changing my life completely and in making me switch from my beloved career of singing to a priority given to literature now.
What are you referring to when you say the legacy that your father left you at his death?
Well, besides the apprenticeship of having worked under the discipline that he always imposed and which I loved, the legacy is an almost intangible thing. After his death, it was as if an obscure, intangible soul of his writing had been at least partially transmitted to me, because I suddenly found myself writing original English, something I had never done before. I can't make it any more precise than that.
Mm-hmm. I heard that you're writing a novel, but under a pen name.
Yeah, I'm writing a novel which is fairly complex, not an imitation of Vladimir Nabokov.
Why are you writing it under a pen name?
To avoid undeserved fame and undeserved blame.
Well, are you under this kind of pressure of, you should really be a genius, your father was?
Maybe I should be, but that's not for me to judge. However, I can say this. I think an engineer's son or a businessman's son is expected to take over the trade, and they're often very brilliant successors to their fathers. In the arts, a son somehow is very vulnerable. He's vulnerable to attack, and he's also vulnerable to being given the illusion that he's good when he's not, simply because he's his father's son. So if the thing flies on its own wings, maybe I'll paint the correct name on the tail.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.